Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of the debate on Press TV. I'm your host, Benoît Zajabi. It's great to have you with us. Now, a cowardly act funded by Saudi Arabia and the UAE and supported by the United States. That's how the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has described Saturday's terror attack on a military parade in the Iranian city of Ahvaz. Iranians paid their last respects to 25 people, among them civilians, including women and children, who lost their lives in that incident. Western media has largely refrained from calling the mishap an act of terrorism. Let's discuss the reason for this double standard and those behind such inhumane acts across the world. Let's get some information in this following report first. Now let's see who's joining us on this edition of the debate. We'll have human rights professor and author of The Plot to Attack Iran, Daniel Kovalik from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and also author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer joining us from London. Now let's begin with the first question I'm addressing Daniel Kovalik. Saudi Crown Prince bin Salman announced last year that they will take the war inside Iran. Now following his comments, the Daesh terror group stormed the Iranian parliament premises. Well, 2 days ago, the Ahvazia terror group also raided this military parade in the Iranian city of Ahvaz. Now following the attack, a former advisor to Abu Dhabi's Crown Prince said that the operation was the realization of objective of transferring conflicts onto Iranian soil and that it would continue in the future. Now, what is the role of Saudi Arabia and the UAE in promoting terrorism in this region, including in Iran?
Well, again, as you just mentioned, the Saudi Arabia in particular is very open about supporting various terrorist groups within the region, including ISIS and ISIL. We know that they've been supporting them in Syria, for example, and they seem to be fighting with them in Yemen right now, with Al-Qaeda even. And we also know that Saudi Arabia has been promoting this radical Islamic strain known as Wahhabism, which of course gave rise to Al-Qaeda. So we know that Saudi Arabia is supporting terrorism within the region and within Iran. Of course, another group that's been operating in Iran is the MEK. And we know that over the weekend, the same weekend this attack happened in Iran, Rudy Giuliani, the lawyer for Donald Trump, was speaking at a summit organized by the MEK. The MEK's killed at least 17,000 Iranians within Iran.
That's right.
And Giuliani was openly speaking about regime change at that meeting. So it's all very clear that this is all part of a low-intensity war against Iran.
Okay, let's go to London. Jonathan Fryer. A secret paper signed in December 2009 by the then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton confirmed that Saudi Arabia is the world's largest source of funds for terrorist groups such as the Afghan Taliban and Lashkar-e-Taiba. Now, Clinton wrote in her secret memo that, quote, more needs to be done since Saudi Arabia remains a critical financial support base for Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and the LET or Lashkar-e-Taiba and other terrorist groups, end of quote. Let's have your reaction on this.
Well, clearly the role of Saudi Arabia in the region and indeed as far away as Afghanistan has been really very negative in recent years. And it's quite right to see that within the framework of what's increasingly an ideological standoff between Saudi Arabia and some of the smaller Persian Gulf states and Iran on the other side. And clearly, the event which took place on Saturday, the awful attack in Ahvaz, quite clearly was a terrorist act and should be called that. We, as you mentioned in your introductory report, two different groups have claimed responsibility. And as the perpetrators themselves were killed, we can't hear from them directly who they were working for. But what is clear is that many of these groups, both as we now see inside Iran, but particularly inside Syria and Iraq, have traditionally received funding from Saudi Arabia and some of its Persian Gulf allies in, as I say, this ideological war against Iran. And from their point of view, it is all about regime change.
Yeah, Jonathan Fryer, for information, those people who got killed, the terrorists, their leader appeared just 1 hour in an interview with a Persian-speaking anti-Iran channel, and he said that they work for the Ahvazia separatist group. Now, let's go to Daniel. Now, in June 2014, then U.S. Vice President Joe Biden accused U.S. key allies in the Middle East, including Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, of allowing the rise of Daesh terrorists, saying that they support extremists with money and weapons in their eagerness to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Now, Biden told a student at the John F. Kennedy Jr. Forum at the Institute of Politics at Harvard University that these countries poured, I'm quoting, hundreds of millions of dollars and tens of thousands of tons of weapons towards anyone who would fight against President Assad. Let's have your take.
Yes, well, I think Biden was absolutely right. Donald Trump said similar things during his presidential campaign. I think all of these folks are just naming the elephant in the living room, and that is that the U.S.'s staunchest allies in the Middle East are also the ones supporting the strongest supporters of terrorism. But the U.S. has to be tagged with this as well. I mean, we have to go back, of course, to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, which was a creature of the United States CIA back in the late 70s and early 80s. One of the leaders, of course, of that being Osama bin Laden himself. Another example, of course, is in Libya, where NATO was really the air force for what became another Islamic State group in Libya, and now throughout the region in northern Africa. And so none of this is a secret. Right after 9/11, the U.S. said it was going to prosecute a war on terror. In fact, they went after every state head that was against al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi. They want to go after Iran, which, of course, is a mortal enemy of al-Qaeda and ISIS. They've gone after Assad, who's a mortal enemy of these groups. None of this makes any standpoint from a from the point of view of fighting terrorism.
Okay, let's go to Jonathan Fryer. Both the Iranian leader and foreign minister have pointed out that the terror group members perpetrating the attack in Iran were trained by Saudi Arabia, at the same time receiving funding and support by the United States. Now the question is, how can Washington speak of the so-called war on terror and then embark on military intervention in other countries, you know, in Afghanistan, elsewhere, under that pretext, while it is funding and sometimes, as the other guest said, creating terrorists itself?
Well, I think the answer is partly in a phrase which was used earlier on in your introduction to this program. In other words, the definition in some people's eyes between good terrorists and bad terrorists. Or one could put that another way, which is often said, that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, and therefore it depends what the cause is that they're fighting for. Now, personally, I would say that terrorist acts are terrorist acts, and it's pretty clear what they are. But the United States has for decades helped armed groups of various kinds try to overthrow governments or intervene in different situations, not only in the Middle East, but indeed in South America and the Caribbean. And sometimes that has been secretly done, as the funding to the Contras in Nicaragua in the 1980s, sometimes very overt. And a lot of the American help for the Saudis and their allies has been very overt. Supplies of weapons and indeed other help of various kinds.
Okay, to Pittsburgh now, Daniel. When Europe is threatened by similar attacks, and we have had instances, as you have heard about them, media jump in immediately. They give the incident full and extensive coverage. Officials also condemn those incidents as acts of terror. But when it comes to Iran, when Iran is hit by the same thing, then little or no media coverage. And then both officials and mainstream media refuse to call it terrorism. Is this anything but double standard, in your opinion?
Yeah, of course it's a double standard. It reminds me of what Noam Chomsky and Edward S. Herman have written about for years, the idea of worthy victims and unworthy victims. The worthy victims in the world, the ones we report on, are when our friends or ourselves are victimized by an attack. However, when our at least ostensible or claimed enemies are attacked, they are not worthy victims. They are not worthy of news coverage. And we see this playing out time and again, and that's exactly what's happening with Iran. Another recent example of this is the recent attempted assassination of President Maduro in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. All the newspapers called it an alleged assassination attempt. They wouldn't even give him that he was truly a victim of an assassination attempt, despite mm-hmm. a video, mm-hmm. you know, clearly yeah. showing this. Mm-hmm. Again, if it's an ostensible enemy, they're not worth giving news or sympathy to.
Okay, General Fry, what do you think? Why should be a little coverage or sometimes no coverage when countries like Iran are hit by terrorism?
Well, of course, it does depend, it vary from country to country. The United States press, with a few notable exceptions, tends to give very little coverage to news beyond its own shores. Here in Europe, we get much more, and I'm pleased to say that the Guardian newspaper, for which I write sometimes, absolutely did have a headline, "Terrorists Attack with Civilians, Women and Children Killed," about others on Saturday. So mm-hmm. what we have here very often depends on the political alignment of the newspapers concerned, particularly in Britain, where most of the newspapers are either aligned to the Conservative Party, which is the ruling party in government now, or favouring the Labour opposition, like The Guardian or other publications. But I agree there is a certain double standard and a hesitation about language. It's a big issue in editorial rooms in London at the moment, because we have a situation where, for example, if a Muslim drives a van into pedestrians, as happened on Westminster Bridge a while back, then mm-hmm. that's called terrorism. But if exactly. a white person drives a van into worshippers outside a mosque, it's called an attack. Now that clearly mm-hmm. is not right. That should be challenged.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Pittsburgh. Daniel, the West keeps differentiating terrorists operating in different parts of the world, depending where they operate. Well, they call them sometimes good terrorists, sometimes bad terrorists, as also Jonathan referred to it, depending on the location where their terrorist operations are taking place. Now, what's the logic behind this categorization? And a terrorist is a terrorist, after all.
Yeah, well, I think the logic is hard to discern many times. If you look again at the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, which the U.S. helped create and funded for years, it then morphed into the Taliban. And who is the U.S. now at war with for 17 years and counting in Afghanistan? The Taliban, the very group we helped give rise to. And yet Americans are supposed to forget this. It truly is an Orwellian world in which we are told we have always been at war with East Asia, even though East Asia used to be our friend. And I think all this is used to justify an eternal war that is not meant to end. It is meant to continue into the future to justify really immoral arms sales around the world.
Okay, let's go to London. Jonathan, some terror groups like the MEK, and also known as MKO, are harbored in Europe and the United States. Now, as it is reported, thousands of MEK members have been transferred from Iraq to Albania by the U.S. Now, the Ahvazia terror group, also the one that just conducted this latest attack in Iran's city of Ahvaz, has its leader based in London. And as I told you, he had an interview. He confirmed that, yes, my man did this. Now, why are they harboring these terror groups in those countries?
Well, I think there are two issues there, basically. I mean, the MEK in particular has been decried officially as a terrorist organization by most member states of the European Union, though, of course, that didn't please them particularly. But the other issue, which I know is very difficult often for people to quite understand, is that London in particular has really a largely open door policy to opposition groups. So here in Britain you will find opposition parties and militant groups of all kinds. Now I think there is a valid question to ask, should that extend hospitality, extend to terrorist groups? And in principle the government says no, it shouldn't, and it doesn't. But in fact, as we know, sometimes some of these groups and some of the so-called political exiles here in London do get involved in violent acts, including assassinations of opponents.
Right. Now, Daniel in Pittsburgh, my last question for you. Now, given the circumstances in the world, you know, like the U.S. claiming that it is fighting terrorism, whereas it is funding and supporting different ways, and we just discussed some of the instances, or some other countries. Now, given these circumstances, terrorism is there. It's a global threat. It's threatening everyone. Europeans were threatened. Americans were threatened, and they will be threatened probably in the future. Who do you think should do what? Should there be a world body? What kind of mechanism could there be in place to effectively, to be disinterested in the first place, and to be able to effectively stop terrorism once and for all? Is this possible at all?
Well, I think it is possible. First of all, there already is a world body to deal with terrorism. There are ways to sanction terrorist groups and to sanction persons and states that support terrorist groups. But again, the problem is it's a matter of the fox guarding the hen house. You know, the U.S., the biggest military power in the world, is the one that's funding terrorism in so many areas. And so that is a huge problem. I think if we want to see an end to terrorism, and maybe we'll never see a complete end, but one way to deal with it is, one, again, states like the U.S. need to stop funding it. And in addition, the U.S. needs to stop intervening in all these places. It needs to pull back its troops. It needs to let other countries like Iran, for example, develop in the way it wants to, progress in the way it wants to. And I think there'll be less reason, of course, for groups in the world to be upset at the West if the West stops fighting everyone. And that, you know, that's essentially what's happening.
Okay, to London, Jonathan Fry, let's have your comments shortly, please.
Yes, well, I'm an optimist and idealist, so I would not want to say, no, it will never be possible to stop terrorism. But I think we also have to acknowledge that it's been around for a very long time in history here in Europe. For example, there were terrorist attacks in the 19th, 18th and 19th centuries. But I think really the problem we have to address, and that probably will be through some United Nations organization, is the arms trade, because that is the biggest terrorism of all, is the fact that billions and billions of dollars are being spent on arms, some of those arms delivered to people who are using them in completely obscene ways, such as we see in Yemen, for example.
Okay, on that note, we...
And of course, may I add that...
Briefly, please.
That the U.S. is the biggest arms dealer in the world, so...
All right. Okay, that's the end of this debate show. I should thank our guests, human rights and labor lawyer Daniel Kowalik, joining us from Pittsburgh, and also author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer, who joined us from London. And we also thank you for watching. We'll see you next time.